It's Wednesday, August 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, new videos allegedly show Islamic State militants destroying an ancient temple in Syria.
The market is oversold, and I think like a stretched rubber band, it's simply snapping back right now as investors try to reevaluate what caused them to be worried.
U.S. financial markets stabilize while Chinese shares fall again. Also ahead, a top commander says the U.S. Pacific Fleet remains strong. New British music from a British top pop viva, and it's all coming up on International Edition. As feared, the Islamic State group, which captured the ancient Syrian caravan city of Palmyra in May, has destroyed the nearly 2,000-year-old Roman-era Baal Shamin Temple. The IS group considers such artifacts that predate Islam as symbols of paganism. The temple's destruction follows last week's beheading of 83-year-old Khalid al-Assad, who had served as the chief of the city's antiquities department for a half century. Trinity University Syria specialist David Leash says that he's visited Palmyra. It, of course, is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and he's been there many times. He told VOA's Victor Beatty the destruction of the temple is a tragedy, but not unexpected to him.
It's not surprising. In fact, I'm surprised it took so long for the Islamic State to blow it up, because it's been their modus operandi to destroy any sort of references to polytheism or pre-Islamic religious belief. So this, unfortunately, is not surprising. You know, it's part of their raison d'etre in terms of making the headlines. If they're not in the headlines for a certain amount of time, they'll do something spectacular, blow up something, or unfortunately behead some people and record it and put it over the social media, and it goes the world over. And for some psychological reason I don't quite understand, it's good for their recruiting. It feeds into the anger of various youth across the world, and they come flocking to this sort of thing.
You've been to Palmyra many times. What is the historical context of this temple? What does its loss represent?
Palmyra was built as a Roman entrepot, a trade way station that reached its height in the 200s CE. And it's one of the great archaeological sites in the world because it was based on Roman architecture. It is essentially a Roman city built in the early years of the Common Era. And yet, since it was in the middle of the desert, the city is basically as it was back then. It's been restored somewhat over the centuries, and particularly by the Syrian government over the last 30, 40 years, as tourism picked up in the country of Syria. But in most cities where there were Roman ruins, there were cities built on top of that. And they usually destroyed many of the Roman ruins to build the new cities, to build the new buildings. They used the stones. They broke them down. Even in Rome itself, it happened quite frequently. Palmyra is one of the few and only examples where it was not broken down, because a new city really wasn't built on top of it. And so when you arrive at Palmyra, the most spectacular sight is that you see the whole city planning. You see the whole city as it was back then, essentially in terms of how it looked, you know, the main streets, the markets, the houses, and so forth. Even though the buildings themselves, for the most part, are obviously in ruined state, but as far as the whole city architecture and planning, it is as it was 2,000 years ago. And if they destroy much more, and unfortunately I suspect they probably will at some point, it would be just such a tremendous loss, archaeologically speaking.
The current head of the Antiquities Department in Syria, Mahmoud Abdul Karim, said the international community must act. There must be some plan. Quote, "I am not a politician or a military man, but in my personal conviction, for the exceptional value of Palmyra, I call upon the international community and all those who are involved in this subject to fight against terrorism. They must move quickly to liberate the city by all means. Otherwise, the international community will lose a beloved city since it's listed on the World Heritage List." Do you think anyone will answer that call?
No, not at all. You know, most of the international community has not acted in force to save the Syrian people. So why would we act in terms of saving a few more ruins that exist? Unfortunately, we'll go a call that is unheeded. But frankly speaking, if we're going to intervene, we need to intervene in other places.
Leash also says as tragic as the destruction in Palmyra is, ending the four-year conflict in Syria remains the top priority. We want to check out and see what people are saying about the incident in Palmyra on social media. To do that, we turn to International Edition's G. Abby Lee, who's right here in Studio 22, to tell us what people are tweeting. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. So I went on to the Topsy Analytics website to see how many times hashtag Palmyra was used in tweets during the last 24 hours. It was used in around 3,000 tweets in English and around 2,800 tweets in Arabic. So the reason why the number of the tweets is so low is because, first, this is not the first attack on Palmyra by ISIL. The Syria specialist who also mentioned this in the Q&A. The group killed a renowned scholar last week who worked on preserving Palmyra for more than 50 years. That news made headlines around the globe. Also, burning down a UNESCO World Heritage site is obviously a horrific act, but the silver lining here is that no one got hurt. So those two might be the reasons why people are not tweeting about it too much.
Well, what are some of the handles that people are tweeting about it?
The State Department's International Organization Affairs Bureau condemned the act. It sent out this tweet about 30 minutes ago. Horrified by ISIL's continued destruction of ruins, including the UNESCO World Heritage Site in Palmyra. The Bureau is on Twitter at state_IO. The Office of the Spokesperson for the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon also criticized the latest move by ISIL. It's on Twitter at UN_spokesperson and tweeted, UNSG Ban Ki-moon, appalled by dash demolition of Palmyra Temple in Syria, says this war crime must be prosecuted. Daesh is yet another name for the Islamic State. Jim?
Well, we have several names to call this terrorist group.
Uh-huh.
ISIL, ISIS, we here at VOA tend to go by simply IS or Islamic State. Thank you so much for that analysis, G. That was G. Abby Lee. And you can find her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. And a lot of E's in there. I'll spell it out for you so you can find her easily. J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. China's central bank cut its benchmark lending rate Tuesday after stock prices in Shanghai plunged another 7.6% to close below the 3,000 mark. That's an eight-month low. Despite the steady slide in Chinese stock prices, however, other world markets began to reverse the steep declines that they suffered earlier this week. Markets here in the United States rebounded Monday before sliding again, rather Tuesday, after the close of trading. Sam Stovall, U.S. equity strategist for S&P Capital IQ, spoke from New York a short time ago with VOA's Peter Heinlein about the volatility and the prospects for more.
Sam, we've seen the financial markets on a wild ride in the past several sessions. You had an article yesterday called "The Wild Ride Isn't Over Yet." What can we expect?
Well, I think that we are going through what's called a counter-trend rally right now. The market is oversold, and I think like a stretched rubber band, it's simply snapping back right now as investors try to reevaluate what caused them to be worried and whether that worry has now dissipated. I don't think it really has. I think we have to reevaluate whether global economic growth is indeed slowing. And is it slowing to the point where we fall into recession or just slowing? And I think that's what investors are focusing on. We'll probably end up remaining within the 10 to 20% decline and not fall into a new bear market.
Well, why is it declining?
Well, I think it's declining primarily because we're just very long into this economic expansion, certainly in the U.S. The stock market itself is 6.5 years old. We've only had two times in which the market reached its seventh birthday since World War II. I think what we're finding is that, yes, employment trends are getting a little bit better here in the States, but the payroll numbers, the actual earnings, are not rising dramatically. And as a result, we just don't seem to have the same kind of demand that we did usually at the beginning of a new economic expansion.
Are we going to see great peaks, highs, and lows coming like they've been the last few days? Can we expect that for the foreseeable future?
Well, maybe not a 1,000-point decline in the Dow Jones Industrial Average that we saw on Monday, August 24th. But volatility in excess of 1% per day, yes, I think that's certainly something we should be prepared for. August is the second most volatile month of the year. And guess which one is the most volatile? That's the one we're heading into, which is September. So I would tell investors, be prepared for additional volatility, fasten your safety belt, but don't don your parachute and assemble by the door. Don't be your portfolio's worst enemy and start selling, because you'll probably do so at the bottom.
Are we then in for a recession, either here in the United States or possibly globally?
I don't think globally, and I don't think a recession in the U.S. either. I think we're going to be continuing to see below-trend growth of about 2 to 2.5%. I think that what makes me feel good that we will not end up in a new recession is housing. In particular, housing starts. In 7 of the last 8 recessions, we have seen a 30% decline in housing starts, whereas right now we're actually looking at a fairly substantial gain in housing starts. Also, the difference between the yield, the interest rate offered on a long bond versus the interest rate that's offered on a 3-month treasury bill is still fairly wide.
So what's your advice to Ma and Pa investor?
My advice to Ma and Pa investor is to just sit on your hands. Don't do anything that you will regret as it relates to your portfolio. You don't have to buy today. You can sit on the sidelines, wait for the dust to settle. But I would certainly say don't sell, because 90% of all declines in excess of 5% turned around before hitting the 20% decline level and ended up getting back to break even in an average of only about 4 months.
Sam Stovall is a U.S. equity strategist for S&P Capital IQ. While the Chinese economy is slipping, its military is growing stronger on the sea. The new commander of the U.S. Navy's Pacific Fleet is seeking to reassure regional allies that the pivot of American military forces will be sustained amid some concerns regarding China's maritime expansion. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Since taking his post 3 months ago at the helm of the Pacific Fleet, Admiral Scott Swift has gone to the Philippines, South Korea, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and Malaysia to meet with counterparts in their navies. Before heading to Singapore, the fleet commander in Kuala Lumpur spoke with a group of reporters via telephone. The admiral acknowledged every place he has visited there is great angst due to the worrying scale and scope of Beijing's reclamation projects in the South China Sea.
Concerns and uncertainty about what the future may hold. But I think what's most important is to come together in a multilateral way and approach reconciling these differences in claims within the region in a positive way and not allow the use of coercion or force as a lever to resolve differences to the benefit of one party or the other.
VOA asked Admiral Swift about the skepticism expressed by U.S. allies regarding the Pentagon's long-term commitment of its much-publicized Pacific pivot.
It's less a reflection of what the United States' ability is to support the refocus. It's more of a reflection of the angst in the theater. As you suggest, many in the countries are concerned about what the future is, and many of them are turning to the United States as a continued guarantor of the stability that they've enjoyed throughout the region, certainly for the last 70 years.
The Defense Department's Maritime Security Roadmap, released last week, has 60% of naval and aviation assets homeported in the Asia-Pacific region by 2020. Japan will be a cornerstone, with Guam as a major strategic hub. There are to be partnerships with Vietnam and India, both rivals of China. And military joint operations are to be expanded with Indonesia, Japan, and Malaysia. The fleet commander says that should reassure all of the U.S. Navy's commitment to the region.
There's a whole litany of examples of how it's not just capacity that is forward deploying, but it's capability as well.
Admiral Swift says he intends to ensure that the Pacific Fleet is the force of choice to respond to any incident which may occur in the region. The admiral, who formerly commanded the 7th Fleet, is also expressing hope of expanding contacts with China's Navy and Coast Guard to try to decrease the elements of instability that are occurring in the region. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Steve Herman has been based in Asia for many years, and he knows it extensively. You can directly benefit from his presence there. All you have to do is follow Steve on Twitter at W7VOA. He's often among the first to report breaking news events there. That's Steve Herman on Twitter at W7VOA. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
British pop diva Rita Ora has a new CD coming out and a new song featuring Chris Brown. My International Edition colleague David Byrd spoke with VOA Border Crossings host Larry London about that new CD and the new song Body on Me.
Maybe you know her from The X Factor in Britain. Maybe you know her from her Oscar-nominated performance. But Rita Ora is lighting up the pop charts with her new song and her new record. Larry, Rita is, she's got a long list of accomplishments.
Oh, yeah.
Not just pop music.
She's pretty hot right now, with, of course, judging on the TV show and endorsing all of these very well-known name brands throughout the UK. She's had, believe it or not, 6 top 5 hits. And of those, she's had 4 number ones in the UK. And she currently recorded a brand new duet with Chris Brown. The video came out this week. Her tour started in the U.S. this week. So she's been very, very busy here in America.
Now, did she write this song that we're talking about, or is this written by somebody else and she's just singing it?
Well, it was, I don't know who wrote it, but the song is directed by Colin Tilley, who has worked with Justin Timberlake and Kendrick Lamar, the video. And the song will appear on her upcoming new album. It doesn't say anywhere whether she wrote it or co-wrote it or had anything to do. She's not known for her writing skills. But she, of course, was nominated for a Billboard Award, Grammy Award with Iggy Azalea for Black Widow. A song from a year ago, and she's making a splash here in America. She's well-established in the U.K., but she's trying to get that same traction here in the U.S.
And
Now, fans also, she's not hard to look at.
Not at
she's
all.
She's a very attractive young woman. And she's got a tour going on. Where are some of the stops on her tour?
Well, the tour begins this week here in the United States, San Francisco, Los Angeles, then Santa Ana, California, Las Vegas, Atlanta, Georgia, Boston, Massachusetts, here in Washington, D.C. in the middle of September. And hopefully I'll get her on Border Crossings.
Well, that'd be great. That'd be fantastic. Well, if you have any comments about Rita Ora's latest single, the title of which is?
It's Body on Me.
The title of it is Body on Me. If you have any comments about that, you can send us a tweet. We're at VOAIE. You can also listen for Larry's program, Border Crossings, on our website. That's www.voanews.com.
Baby, let's cut down the lights. I just really want to let this fire burn bright. I'm just telling you to have an open mind. Just imagine us. You're taking me there, you're taking me there. All of your belly touching. So do it again, so do it again. We could be on to something.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can always find us at our website. It's voanews.com. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia on Facebook, and Twitter is VOA_IE. Our director today, Tracy Carter, and our engineer is Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We thank you so much for joining us and hope you enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
70 years ago this month, the victors of the Second World War, horrified by crimes committed by the Nazi regime, issued a decree for the prosecution of three crimes. Crimes against peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. The decree, now known as the Nuremberg or London Charter, established that perpetrators of murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, and other inhumane acts committed against the civilian population before or during the war could not hide behind their official position in government, nor their obedience to orders from above, to avoid criminal responsibility for participating in such horrendous acts. Since then, these principles have served as the basis for successive provisions on war crimes and crimes against humanity in the statutes of international hybrid and domestic tribunals that have charged and prosecuted hundreds of individuals, from the foot soldier all the way up to the head of state, for such crimes. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia indicted 161 people for crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide committed during the Balkan Wars in the 1990s. Including former Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic and other political and military leaders. Similarly, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda indicted 93 individuals accused of being responsible for the 1994 Rwandan genocide, including dozens of political and military officials. And in Sierra Leone, a special hybrid court convicted, among others, former Liberian President Charles Taylor, for his role in aiding, abetting, and planning atrocities committed by rebels in the civil war there. At one point, these individuals may have believed that they would never have to answer for their crimes. They might have felt justified when perpetrating atrocities because their actions were part either of government policy or of a wide practice that was tolerated or condoned by the government. But no one is above the law. From sexual violence in eastern Congo to the brutal torture in the Assad regime's prisons in Syria, we will continue to seek accountability for the world's worst crimes, wrote Secretary of State John Kerry on the occasion of the 70th anniversary of the London Charter. Such accountability is a stabilizing force in international affairs, and it is what our values and the memory of the victims demand.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.